Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Originally, I had in mind a repeat program for today. It is the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. I always prefer live programming, and generally, if the studio might be closed for a real holiday, like Thanksgiving Day or Christmas, New Year's, the other holidays, PRN stays open. At least they have in the past, and hopefully they will ahead. So if my programs come up on a holiday weekend or day, we go live. And if they don't, then I would prefer to tape a fresh program in advance and have that one on. Well, I was a little bit confused this weekend, so I taped one program in advance. That aired yesterday, and I plan a repeat program today. But at the same time, I scurried around, and I found a guest. He'll join us shortly. He's Mickey Huff. Possibly I'll try to get two guests if able to get the second one. I don't know of one yet, but if he is reached and lets me know, I'll get him on as well, because the guest who will come on shortly, Mickey Huff. Mickey can only stay a short while. I'll carry on for the rest of the hour if the other guest is unable to come on. But Mickey is a California-based professor of history. He's a professor at Diablo Valley College. He's also the director of Project Censored and the Media Freedom Foundation. And the new Project Censored book is out. Talked about it briefly with the Associate Project Censored Director on a past program, Andy Roth. It's Censored 2013. It can be bought on the Project Web Project Censored store. You can either Google Project Censored or Google projectcensored.org/store. I've read, and I've got on my shelves, at least a dozen of the Project Censored books. I think I've actually got more than that. I've got a bunch of them, and pretty soon I'm going to need a whole shelf just for their books. They are really extraordinary, and what's even more extraordinary is that each year they seem to get better. I've got the brand new one, the Project Censored 2013 book. It is really crammed with vital stuff. Key topics that we've discussed in this program. I've certainly had my say on a bunch of them. And it's information everybody needs to know, like the top censored story we talked briefly about when Andy Roth was on a few weeks ago, America Becoming a Police State. That was my feature year-end article in 2008, December 2008. I wrote an article I called Police State America. And it was very hard to refute what I wrote, because what I did is I went back and I reviewed all the post-9/11 laws that passed, the presidential executive orders, the various memoranda that passed, and so-called presidential security and national security directives. There's an official word for those. I forget the precise terminology. But directives pertaining either directly from the president or based on national security. And these things are available. You can look them up. Haven't done it for a while. And the more added, I imagine, from time to time. And just from this information, it was very easy to draw the conclusion that America is a police state. And that was in December 2008. Boy, it's gotten worse. You know, Obama was supposed to be a different sort of guy than Bush, and I've written volumes on Obama. I've written so many articles throughout his nearly 4 years. The last 3 years, I wrote a year-end review. I may do it again later in December. And it really is a nightmarish scenario of just how bad things have gotten. We went from a police state to a meaner and nastier police state, complete with warrantless searches, eyes in the spies spying on us, all kinds of surveillance. Many cities like my own in Chicago are just littered with surveillance cameras. You can't go anywhere in downtown Chicago without a camera or two or three or a dozen picking you up. I'm surprised they haven't stuck one in our homes, in our bedrooms, in our bathrooms, in our living rooms. Maybe they'll get around to that, or maybe they'll come up with a technology so that they can dispense with cameras and just do it some other ways. There actually is a technology, I remember writing about it briefly, this was a few years ago, that there's some kind of a satellite-based technology that can literally penetrate solid walls and either listen, maybe it was listen, can't imagine how you can do it in view, but let's say listen to what's going on inside, penetrate solid walls, maybe it is view. It's been a good while, and I don't remember exactly what I wrote. Probably was 4 or 5 years ago that I wrote it. But the surveillance is intense. The police state laws get nastier and nastier. The wars never end. They just kind of wind down a little bit. Troops still stay. America doesn't go to war theaters to leave. America plans permanent occupation of Iraq, of Afghanistan, Libya, directly and by proxy, what's going on in Syria right now. Very serious business that I wrote about in an article that'll go out tomorrow. I've been writing daily articles on Gaza and Hamas, and I'll talk about that a little bit. Hopefully Mickey will join in maybe a couple of minutes or a few minutes. I'll get the cue when he does, and I'll jump right into his comments because he can only stay for a short while. I'll get back to Gaza, but from November 15th today, after so-called Operation Pillar of Cloud began, I began writing on that day, and the articles I write in one day go out the next day. Except for one day, I wrote two articles every day on it. I've got two more on Gaza going out tomorrow. One of them has information very relevant about Syria. And there have been headlines, I think a lot of listeners have heard this, that America plans to be deploying Patriot missiles on the Turkish-Syria border. Well, there's a Russian analyst that I quoted. He calls that a no-fly zone. I honestly hadn't thought of that. But it's something to really reflect on and wonder whether it really will be used for that purpose. And I'll be unequivocal. A no-fly zone, whether in the air or its ground equivalent called a safe haven, those are declarations of war. They're acts of war. And I do remember quoting a U.S. general. Before Resolution 9, I remember the resolution number, very unusual, in Libya last year in March, I believe it was the 17th of March, and it was UN Security Council Resolution 1973, authorizing a no-fly zone. Before that resolution passed, why Russia and China didn't veto it, they'll have to explain. They understood, no excuses. I understood. If I understood, they understood. But they let it pass. They've been more hardline not letting the very dangerous resolutions against Syria pass. I hope they don't let up on that. But they let 1973 go through. And within 24 hours or so, French planes were over Libya, and the bombing began straight away. And it didn't stop until late in the year. It was supposed to stop in October. I don't know the precise date that the bombing stopped, but it went on every single day, dozens of sorties, horrific amounts of munitions dropped on Libya, civilians deliberately targeted. Don't listen to the scoundrel media. Don't listen to the official NATO reports or the official Washington reports. They all lie. Civilians in all U.S. wars, in all Israeli wars, are legitimate targets, they claim. Of course, doing that, international law states unequivocally, is a war crime. And if you do other things related to that type of bombing, you've committed crimes against humanity. There's no ambiguity about that stuff. It's right there in black and white. But Israel actually gave it a name, and I've mentioned it on this program. They call it Dahiya. I think we mentioned it on Friday. Dahiya. Dahiya is a town on the suburbs of Beirut in Lebanon, and Israel destroyed it in 2006. And a couple of Israeli generals I quoted in articles said they consider civilians legitimate combatants, including children, because they can grow up to be combatants. Maybe they kill pregnant mothers because the baby in their womb might grow up to be a combatant, so that makes the fetus a legitimate target. Rogue states think this way, but I just took the words that the generals themselves said, and I quoted them, and I let them hang themselves. They did a pretty good job. I didn't have to amplify much in what they said. And there was a colonel I also quoted, and they said a lot more nasty things as well, like wanting to bomb Lebanon back 20 years in the past, and they said the same thing about Gaza. So they did it twice to Gaza. Horrendous war crimes committed at the end of 2008, 2009, January, 23 days. Reports, Goldstone report, UN Human Rights Council report, they were pretty unequivocal. Those are very serious war crimes committed. Well, the worm is now turned. The Human Rights Council no longer looks at human rights. It became an arm of Imperial America, Imperial NATO, Imperial Israel. What went on in Gaza for 8 bloody days, we don't know what the final death count is of that. Officially, it's something like 170-odd, over 1,000 injured, many of them horrific injuries, lots of people maimed for life. Who knows? Who keeps count? Who cares? Well, I care. I wrote about it every day. Human Rights Council, where are they? Not a word, not a peep. Israel murdered these people. The pretexts they were given were absolutely false. The war was planned many months in advance. I explained that. No war, no campaign, big or small, takes place impromptu. Impossible. Israel admitted, probably true, on the ground it could be verified, that they bombed something like 1,500 separate sites. 1,500 sites. Imagine the amount of time it takes to plan those kind of sites to be attacked. You don't do that in a day or a week or a month. It takes very detailed planning. Every conflict, whether it's an 8-day one, 23-day one, or a war that can go on who knows how long, planning is very, very intense, very longer term. It'll be fine-tuned as you go along, what you thought about a year ago or 6 months ago. It may change a little bit before you actually start dropping bombs and shelling. Well, in an article I put out this morning, I wrote that Mahmoud Abbas, the so-called president of Palestine, who has no legitimacy whatsoever, Israel rigged his election, his term. He was put in office in 2005. His term expired in January 2009. He's still there. He's a useful stooge, so Israel and Washington keep him there. Well, ahead of Kassled, months ahead, he was informed it was coming. He urged Israel to annihilate Hamas in what turned out to be Kassled. And in the article I put out this morning, I've written on the theme a number of times. I've called Abbas what he is, a longtime Israeli collaborator, a guy who's the president of your country, and he's a traitor. Well, I compared him to Quisling in Norway during the Nazi occupation, the Vichy government in France, and the other rogue states in Nazi-occupied Europe that sold out their own people for whatever they got in return. Well, that's what Abbas is. I asked a question in my article this morning. What did he know about Operation Pillar of Cloud, and when did he know it? I'd like to get an answer to that. He won't answer me. For certain he won't answer me. I'm certain that he may know about my articles. He'll know that I am not one of his allies, not at all. I don't take kindly to treason. I don't take kindly to people being brutalized for over 64 years, under occupation for over 45 years. and the way this latest conflict began. You know, Israel always comes up with a reason. We were only defending ourselves. These rockets that were coming in and targeting our people. Well, that was a bald-faced lie because there were multiple Israeli provocations. There were attacks on Gaza. There were Gazans killed. And after multiple provocations, which is what always happens when something like this breaks out, Hamas finally responded. It not only is their right to respond, it's their obligation. That's what governments are supposed to do. They're supposed to protect their people, not let an outside force kill them. No responsible government would allow that to happen. But Hamas always puts up with plenty before they respond. And the other resistance groups pretty much do the same thing. Well, you can only take so much, and then you respond. And the straw that broke the camel's back, a small one, was killing a 12-year-old boy. The big one was killing a man named Ahmed Jabari. He was the head of the Defense Force of Gaza, the Qassam Brigades. He was also a very influential political figure. He had negotiated with Israel and succeeded in getting a draft truce agreement within 24 or 48 hours before Pillar of Cloud began. He had it in his hand. Israel had agreed, no more fighting, no more attacks, no more rockets. Israel murdered him. It's not the first time they've done something like that. They did a similar incident, pulled off a similar incident before the horrific 1982 Lebanon War. I remember quoting Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, and he said something to the effect that there was a crisis in Israel, the threat of peace. Those were almost his exact words, the threat of peace. Israel had to do anything it could to subvert it. They staged, or there was an incident in London against the Israeli ambassador. It had nothing to do with the Palestinians, nothing whatsoever. But the ambassador was severely hurt. I think he almost died, but I think he recovered. I'd have to go back and check. It's been a while since I wrote about it. But Israel used that as a provocation to go to war with Lebanon, targeting the Palestinians and Yasser Arafat at the time and other PLO officials who were in Lebanon. And before that was over, 18,000 people were murdered. The infamous Sabra and Shatila refugee camps were targeted. Ariel Sharon was directly involved. He was defense minister at the time. He used a proxy force, a Lebanese phalangist, fascist proxy force. And he basically told them to go in and slaughter every man, woman, and child in sight, and they did. And I wrote about it. I wrote about it a few times. Once, pretty good detail, pretty ugly story. And believe it or not, he was chastised for doing that in Israel. That's impossible to happen today. But he wasn't fired. I don't recall exactly whether he stayed on as defense minister, but I know he came back as a housing minister, and then he became prime minister. So you go from war criminal to another ministerial post to the prime minister's post. That's called justice in Israel. So Israel provoked the Lebanon War. It's provoked every single conflict with the Palestinians, bar none. Hamas has never attacked aggressively. I don't think Islamic Jihad has, or the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. There could be a fringe group here or there, for whatever reason, with small memberships or whatever, who occasionally might do something provocative on their own. But it certainly is not the government of Palestine. And Hamas is the government of Palestine, not Abbas, not Fatah. That's the Israeli-installed coup d'etat government. The legitimate government is Hamas. In January 2006, it was democratically elected, not just elected, but elected overwhelmingly. Fatah, at that point, was completely out of favor. It was corrupt. The Palestinians simply wanted nothing more to do with them. They didn't rout all of their officials, but the defeat was extremely decisive, and Hamas became the government. And they were straight away targeted by Israel. Israel may have even wanted Hamas. I think at the time Israel knew Fatah was unelectable. Unelectable. So in that sense, it was a fait accompli that Hamas would be elected. But that served Israel's purpose. Israel loves Hamas. Israel needs enemies. Israel didn't wage gas lead and pillar of cloud to destroy Hamas. Wanted to destroy its offensive capability, you know, bomb and blow up its weapons, maybe cow it a little bit, make it more submissive. So Israel wanted to weaken Hamas, not destroy Hamas. If Hamas didn't exist, Israel would have to invent another enemy. Just like bin Laden for America. Bin Laden, of course, died in December 2001. Obama had nothing to do with killing him. He's not a cat. He only had one life. Be quite any trick to kill a dead man. Well, that was a staged event. I don't know who was killed, but it certainly wasn't bin Laden. At the time, the New York Times even reported his death. Fox News, before there was TV, Fox, I think, December 2001, Fox News even reported bin Laden's death. But that stuff gets put down the memory hole. And, I mean, it's there in the archive someplace, but, of course, the media scoundrels never bring it out. They come up with a new storyline. Anyway, what bin Laden was for America, Hamas is for Israel. They need enemies. So America pretended, Washington pretended that bin Laden was still alive. I can remember writing about Saddam before the 2003 Iraq War, that he literally came to America via room service. He literally was a room service enemy. You don't make them much better than that. And America took full advantage, and Israel took full advantage. So if you don't have enemies, you invent them. It's a lot easier if you can pick somebody who's a little bit nasty, or maybe a whole lot nasty, like Saddam, and use them as your enemy. But America has lots of nasty, nasty despots that are some of its closest allies. I can't think of any nastier one than Israel. I don't make that statement lightly. I make it based strictly on the facts. The facts don't lie. Anybody can find them out the same way I do. That's what I do when I research and write my articles. I look for the truth, and whatever it is, that's where I go. And if I make a mistake, I'll correct it and say so. I'm certain I make some. Nobody's perfect, I'm sure not. Let me get back to Syria just for a moment, because I mentioned that and I passed over it too quickly. If the Russian analyst that I quoted is right, then putting Patriot missiles on the Syrian border inside Turkey with a considerable range, I guess his thinking is that would create a safe zone in Turkish and in Syrian territory, covering so many kilometers, a good many kilometers. And that's called a no-fly zone. So any Syrian aircraft flying in its own airspace over this territory that Patriot missiles can hit, well, I would bet probably they're going to be targeted, those planes. I've said in so many articles that I expect America and NATO to get into this fight the same way they did in Libya. And repeatedly, NATO official statements and Washington official statements absolutely will not get involved directly. Well, America's been involved before day one. America planned this conflict. This is America's war in Syria. It's not a rebel forces war. They were enlisted, they were recruited, they're paid, they're mercenaries. They're brought in from other countries in the region, all over, from Libya, same crew that fought against Gaddafi last year, same types. Afghanistan, Chechnya, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, you name it. Wherever America and other Western countries and their regional allies can recruit the meanest and nastiest people of all, they recruit them, they pay them, whatever they do, whatever they promise them, and they get them to fight their wars for them. I don't know why. I scratch my head and I say, I don't know why they're fighting another Arab country. The real enemy is Israel. But they're not fighting Israel. They're fighting another Arab country. I'm certain one day they'll realize that they picked on the wrong target. And maybe they'll do something about it. Who knows? I am no fan of conflict, no matter who it's done by or who it's done to. Everything I've written about, the only conclusion I've ever been able to come up with is that violence begets more of it. And the only way to solve problems is to do it diplomatically. Otherwise, you never solve them. And look at America. Literally endless wars, and they didn't just begin post-World War II. They went back to before the Republic was founded. Well before. The Indian Wars began long before that. The extermination went on every year without end through pretty much the entire 19th century. And the extermination continues. It's called cultural extermination. And according to the genocide definition, that's called genocide. That continues. You know, save the man, but kill the Indian. I think that was the title of a Ward Churchill book. Pretty close to that. Hitler modeled his extermination program after America's. And he said, how can America complain? They did this. I'm just doing what they did. He was right. So who did Israel model their extermination campaign after? Probably a number of despots. And they add their own twist to it. I call it slow motion genocide. It's been going on for 64 years. Slow motion. Israeli historian Elan Pape says the same thing. Francis Boyle, distinguished law professor, human rights expert. He was on the program about 10 days ago. He says the same thing. I'm sure other people say it as well. It's what it is. You either get rid of them, drive them out of the country, kill them, repress them so deeply they literally don't have an arm to lift up to resist you. And then the ones that are completely cowed and unable to resist for their own freedom, you turn them into serfs, virtual slaves. That's the name of the game. That's the name of the game in Libya, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, whether the occupier is America, whether it's Israel, that's the name of the game. And anybody who sticks their head up and says, I don't like this system, they can bet they're going to get their head chopped off. Very ugly business. Keeps me busy writing about it all the time. I think on Gaza alone since November 14th, I lost count. I think I passed 20 articles. I've got two more going out tomorrow. And they're very blunt. And in one of them, I quote the current UN Rapporteur for Human Rights in Palestine, Richard Falk. I put a section in the end on an article that I called Netanyahu Plans More War, because I really feel very strongly that he does plan more war. There's been so much going on. I've never seen a peace initiative out of Israel. There never has been one in over 64 years. Why would anybody expect one now? I don't. But Richard struck a note of hope. And he sees something different in the so-called Memorandum of Understanding ceasefire terms that were agreed to a few days ago, last week. And he explained very eruditely his reasons for thinking, just maybe, he's not sure, but just maybe something may be different this time. Things are a little different, or playing out at the moment, just a little bit different than they did before. For me, it's not different enough to matter, because the term settling operation Pillar of Cloud really were about the same as the ones after Cass led. And the conflict never stopped. The killing went on. The repression went on. It doesn't compute in my head that it'll be any different now. And I quoted Netanyahu, his own words. You know, you have to do a little reading between the lines, but he said, we will do whatever we have to defend Israel's security. Well, nobody threatens Israel. Hamas doesn't threaten Israel. Let me pause on that point, and we'll take a break and come back, and we'll pick it up. Welcome back. Your host is the guest today. I always prefer to have a guest to myself. It looks like Mickey Huff, he was quite involved, and he said he would try to get on for a short time. It looks like he was more involved than he thought, and it doesn't look like Mickey will be able to get on. Well, in any event, in a pinch, I can always fill in, and I've had, and I get many interviews myself on the topics that are discussed on this program with other guests. But I always prefer to have a guest rather than be host and guest myself. But when pressed into it, I can be a switch hitter. I'm very comfortable doing both, so I can handle both sides. But let me mention one other thing about Hamas. Well, I mentioned they're the legitimate government of Palestine. There's another story floating in the independent media today that Hamas would like to prioritize, after all the coup d'etat Fatah government did to them, collaborating with Israel, Abbas and others around him, not all of the PLO members, not at all, or not all of the Fatah members, but a good number of them. They'll have to speak for themselves. I can name a few names, but certainly Abbas, and he's been a traitor, at least going back to the Oslo Accords, that almost 20 years ago, next year, September, where he literally sold out. The Palestinians got nothing from Oslo, absolutely zero, zero. And so-called final status talks that were supposed to follow the talks over 19 years later, they never happened. And they never will, based on what's going on now. And as far ahead as I can see, I mentioned Richard Falk. He sees some hope. I hope he's right. He sees some things that are different this time than he's seen before. He wrote a very scholarly analysis of it. I mentioned some of it in the article that I wrote. And basically, I'll just sum it up by saying, I don't agree. I don't see anything for me to be hopeful about, because I know the history of Israel. I know Netanyahu, who literally, I've said it so many times, he's a thug, plain and simple, a thug. He's right up there with the world's worst despots. I just can't imagine he's going to give an inch. But I hope I'm wrong, and I hope Richard is right. And again, he listed the reasons that he sees. I can't imagine anything I'd rather be more wrong about than this, along with hopefully figuring out a way where maybe America will decide that a peace is better than war, but if there's nothing in sight about that either. So the wars go on, the human misery goes on, the killing, the destruction. It goes on without end, and the Middle East is plagued by all that oil. It should be a blessing, but it's a curse. America and Israel could target anybody, because Israel lives in the region, so they want to be the boss in the region. They want to be a regional hegemon. America wants to be a global hegemon. And the scheme is basically the same, divide and conquer. Get rid of your main enemies. Break them up, balkanize them. That's what happened to Yugoslavia in the 1990s, throughout the decade. So the official term is balkanizing. That's exactly what Israel has wanted to do for decades. Take on your enemies, get rid of them, break them up into small states based on ethnicities, Sunni versus Shia, small powerless states, so that Israel is the one dominant power in the region. and then America backs them up with its might, and it becomes the global hegemon. In an article I got out this morning, I quoted Henry Kissinger, of all people. If he's still around next May, he'll be 90 years old. Well, I quoted him. He gave an interview, and I quoted from it. And one of his comments was, if you can't hear the war drums beating, you're deaf. It's probably the only thing he said I agree with. The war drums are beating, so I have to agree with Henry and not with Richard. And ground zero is the Middle East for now, Central Asia, Afghanistan, surrounding areas. Any country that may have ties to Russia would be a target. And the ultimate targets are Russia and China. America can't rule the world unless it controls both those countries. Will they want to do it by war? It's hard to imagine America would want a war with either of those countries because they're both powerful and they can fight back. And bullies, as I've said many times, always like to pick soft targets. So Israel picks soft targets, Hamas, Palestinians in general, Lebanon. America did its fighting for it in Iraq. But maybe Israel could have handled Iraq. Well, it couldn't have invaded too easily. There's a little stretch of territory between the two countries. That would have been pretty tough to manage. Israel could have conducted a ferocious bombing campaign, done an awful lot of damage. But it really needed America to provide the ground troops. So it got them. I can't imagine a war with Iran, although I think the possibility of one happening, maybe next year, is very, very real. Iran is no soft target. Iran is no threat to anybody in the region, just like Hamas is no threat to anybody in the region. But you need enemies, so you invent them. America hasn't had an enemy since Japan surrendered in August of 1945. Not a single enemy that I know of. So all the wars that America fought, the direct ones, the proxy ones, all the enemies were invaded. They all wanted peace. They wanted nothing to do with war. In the Middle East, the only enemies Israel has are the ones it invents. And there's certainly no threat from Syria. Syria's wanted peace with Israel for years. And they both border each other. So you would think it would be in the interest of both to want peace with each other, to have a legitimate peace agreement and end the conflict. But it never happened since the 67 war in 1967. And Israel still occupies Syrian territory. It won't give it back. Well, Israel wants territory. But the territory, a good bit of what it occupies, is water rich. And that's reason enough for Israel to want it and not want to give it back. That was the reason for invading Lebanon until Israel pulled out in 2000, last time, I believe. Israel wanted to control Lebanon at least up to 20 miles in, up to the Litani River, water. When you live in the desert, water is always valuable, but it's especially valuable when you live in the desert. So that's what Israel wanted, plus control, plus offshore there's oil and gas, you know, same things. Offshore Gaza, oil and gas, I think mainly gas, but where you find gas is oil, where you find oil is gas. That belongs to Palestine, doesn't belong to Israel. Off Lebanon, sure, belongs to Lebanon, doesn't belong in Israel. Israel wants it all. Well, they can fight Hamas, they can fight Lebanon if it wants to. They're soft targets. Syria is no soft target. Iran for sure is no soft target, including for America. And Russia and China absolutely are no small targets. They're both nuclear armed. They both threaten no one. They both want peace, not war. I don't know what America has in mind. It's hard for me to conceive a war breaking out with either of those two countries, but it can happen. It can happen. Sometimes it can happen even if you don't want it. One event leads to another, and all of a sudden you get a war in your hands. America would prefer to take them both down other ways, economically, politically. Pretty tough. so-called mutual assured destruction kept the war during hot war breaking out during the Cold War. But there were U.S. generals who wanted to go to war with Russia, including when Kennedy was president, and I remember writing about it a couple of times. Kennedy wanted nothing to do with any of them. Same types wanted another Bay of Pigs. I wrote once about how Kennedy, during a national security meeting, when somebody, a general attending it, wanted to invade Cuba again, he got so enraged he just got up and walked out. He also wanted to end the Vietnam War. He hadn't really picked up to a full head of steam, but he originally put troops into Vietnam, and then they decided he made a mistake. He wanted them all out, beginning with an initial contingent of about 1,000. I just wrote about this again in an article. And then by the end of 1965, if he was still president, to have them all out. He deplored the CIA. He wanted to rip it to pieces and get rid of it. Instead, they ripped him to pieces and got rid of him. He supported Palestinian liberation. He absolutely opposed Israel's nuclear bomb program and said so. He told Ben-Gurion that, first prime minister. He deployed the idea of Israel developing and having nuclear. Israel had nuclear weapons at that time in the 1960s. They had them in the 1950s. Not the arsenal they have today, but they had them. Israel deployed that. He deployed the occupation of Palestine. Probably the only American president who ever did and said so. He was my commencement speaker in 1956. He was a senator. That was the context I wrote about. I did it a couple of times. And I marvel at the fact that presidents today don't speak the way he did. Very scholarly, very thoughtful. The important things that he said still moves me to this day. Because I got the text of the speech. I didn't remember it from all those years back. I got the text of the speech, and I wrote about it from the text. It was really a marvelous talk, a marvelous, marvelous talk. And 1956 again, he was a senator. One of his lines was that there was a great connection between politicians and world-famous scholars back in the 19th century. He said that continued for about a century. With political figures, not all of them, of course, but political figures, a good number of them, are some of the important ones. They understood the teachings of these famous people, and maybe they took some of them to heart. He said that continued for about a century, and then it faded away. I think Kennedy on his own reflected that from the people that he quoted. Extraordinary figures, and he just rattled them off. Amazing. And he quoted a mother. I think it was a mother. It was a mother. Who said to the effect that she didn't want her son in college learning poetry. She wanted him learning something where he could go out and use it to make a living from. And Kennedy took that comment and said to the effect that if more politicians knew poetry and more poets understood the political goings-on, and the final line of his speech was, maybe then... This commencement day, I think it was June 14th, this commencement day of June 14th, 1956, maybe then the world would be a better place on this commencement day, June 14th, 1956. I'm still very moved by that line. Simple statement, profound meaning, affects me greatly. Nobody around talks that way today. They just talk about the enemies they have to get rid of to make the country safe when America has no enemies, so we invent them and go around killing people. It would be be nice to have a change of pace and have a president who thought that maybe peace is a better idea than war. Wouldn't be good for business, would it? The world would sure be a better place and a safer place. It's the kind of world I want to live in. I'm glad I'm not young. I've said it many times. I'd hate to be growing up in this world. It's pretty violent when I was a kid growing up. I remember World War II. No television. But my dad would come home from work, put on the radio, and listen to the nightly war reports. So that was the radio that played, and that's what I heard. And there were members of my family in the war. Thankfully, they all came back. They all came back. I was too young. I was just a kid. And I don't remember the day it started. I was just a small boy. Ironically, it was, I don't know that it was on the very day, but it was very close to the very day of my first day in kindergarten when I was about 5 years old. So I didn't really understand too much then. I believe World War II began on the 1st of September, 1939. That's just about when my kindergarten began, and I remember my first day very well because I was so terrified to be leaving home. I had no idea where my mother was taking me. What does a five-year-old understand? It would have really been horrific if on that very day when I was scared to death with no reason to be. There were people in Poland who had every reason to be scared to death because the war began. A false flag, of course. A pretext. Hitler invented it. German troops posed as Polish ones, committed some kind of a violation, killing whatever, cross-border. World War II began. France was invaded, so on and so forth. London Blitz, Holocaust, you name it. And the stuff never ended. One war ends, another one begins. No time for peace. Again, the war profiteers wouldn't tolerate peace. The bankers don't tolerate peace. They cash in on all this stuff. War is big business. Take the profit out of war and you'd end them. Who'd want to go to war if you couldn't make a buck out of it? Pretty lousy world to grow up in. Violent as it was for me as a boy growing up, and I remember Korea, I was in college, I was vulnerable to be drafted. And I can remember as a freshman, I and others saying, we sure better keep our grades up or we're going to end up in the frozen chosen. That was in North Korea, the reservoir. And the winters up there can get pretty, pretty cold and nasty just to be there, never mind fight a war there. So it was great incentive to keep our grades up so we wouldn't get drafted and sent off to war. And the armistice came before I finished 1953. I graduated in 1956. But it wasn't a pleasant time, and none of us knew what might be coming or whether we'd get a nasty letter in the mail one day saying, we want you. Well, it didn't happen. And at the same time, the Vietnam business was stirring up. French was certainly involved. Eisenhower was involved. And then the war became full-blown. And that war was unwinnable. And in the book that he wrote, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara admitted, and I quoted him verbatim in one or two articles that I wrote, that in 1965, 10 years before America pulled out, he told Lyndon Johnson that we could never beat these people. We simply can't win the war. He knew it. Generals knew it. Johnson knew it. 10 more years of war. Johnson couldn't run for re-election. And the war ended up shortening his life. It did a job on him, from bigger than life to a hollow man to an early grave. Obama did the same thing. He was reelected. He's got 4 more years to kill and destroy. And he'll take full advantage. Make no mistake about it. Syria's probably next. Iran's on the target list. North Sudan, Lebanon, Hezbollah. I don't know what they'll do with Hamas. Again, Israel needs an enemy. Hamas is convenient. It needs to provoke a few rockets coming back in self-defense every now and then so they can claim there are terrorists in Gaza and maintain this suffocating siege that's been a five-year and running humanitarian crisis. And I quoted from a Jerusalem Post editorial in an article I wrote today, Jerusalem Post saying, the blockade doesn't exist. The blockade doesn't exist. There's a five-year-plus humanitarian crisis going on every day of the week. Essential stuff can't get in, or not enough of it. And now you've got all this horrendous destruction that has to be rebuilt, and most construction materials are banned. So how are they going to rebuild? How are they going to do it? The tunnels are being bombed. Don't lionize the president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi. He's a collaborator just like Abbas. He's working with Israel. He's working with Washington. A billion or two in blood money from Washington buys a lot of complicity. And he gives back a lot in return. That's irrespective, at least to some extent, of the headlines now, where he is seizing more power than he deserves. Well, in Egypt, the military has the ultimate say. If the military doesn't like what he's doing, they'll be ready for him to put somebody else in. Anyway, well, unless Washington says, no, he's our guy. Hands off. We'll be the final decision maker on what he can do and not do, and that's true. Because basically, America runs Egypt. $1 billion to $2 billion a year, buys a lot of authority, and America takes full advantage. So Morsi is complicit with America, complicit with Israel. Getting rid of these tunnels that are a lifeline for Gaza with the blockade. They bring in essentials, not enough of it, but they bring in stuff that ordinary people need, including construction materials to rebuild. That's the way most of it comes in. Egypt put poison gas in the tunnels, and so did Israel. And they killed some Gazans in the tunnels. I don't know how frequently they did this, but they did it. And they did it just recently, within the last week. You may have heard the headlines that maybe they've already begun arriving. They certainly will very, very quickly. Where Obama decided to deploy U.S. troops to Sinai. Sinai is Egypt. It borders on Gaza. U.S. troops will now guard the Gazan-Egypt border. The Israeli-controlled Gazan-Egypt border. Why? Because America has the most sophisticated weapons. They've got all the terror weapons. They've got plenty of poison gas. They use it. They use nuclearized weapons, depleted uranium, and even some direct uranium bombs. And Israel uses illegal weapons in all the wars that both countries fight. And it shows up in injured people in hospitals, where they come in with injuries never seen before. I'm just about out of time. I should wrap it up. It's amazing how fast the hour goes. When I'm the host and I have a guest, the hour flies. And when I'm interviewed, the time flies. It could be a brief interview, anywhere from 5 minutes. I think the longest one I ever had ran, I've had a couple that ran a couple of hours, but that's very unusual. I had one, a month or so ago, that ran about an hour and 10 minutes. And I was asked to stay longer, but I had to leave because I had another interview. Usually they run anywhere from 5 minutes to 15, 20, 30. Occasionally a little bit longer. On radio, on U.S. radio, they run longer. They can run a whole hour. And I love to do them because these are big things. These are the things I write about all the time. I wrote about them in my two books. I have a new book coming out very, very shortly, and I'll announce it when it comes out. The title is called Banker Occupation, Waging Financial War on Humanity. It's a follow-up to my Wall Street book. I'll tell you more about it when it comes out. I hope it won't be too long. It's all written. Join us next week. We're on every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit, and we'll be live next week. I have scheduled guests. I'll go back to playing host. That's what I prefer to do. Join us. Make us a regular habit.